It's really the internal that matters, that internal motivation and strength.
Mm-hmm.
And often that is quiet.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome back Steve Magnus on the show. Steve is a world-renowned expert on high performance. He has been a consultant on mental skills development for professional sports teams, including some of the top teams in the NBA. Steve is the co-author of Peak Performance, The Passion Paradox, and the author of The Science of Running. Collectively, his books have sold more than 250,000 copies in print, ebook, and audio formats. And his latest book, which is the topic of our discussion today, is called Do Hard Things. In this episode, I talked to Steve Magnus about real toughness. The prevailing narrative around achievement extols the merits of unrelenting resolve. To show vulnerability is to show weakness. According to Steve, the hyper-focus on external bravado is detrimental to performance and mental health. He outlines his four core pillars of resilience to replace our broken model of toughness. We also touch on the topics of stoicism, self-esteem, emotions, mindfulness, and sports psychology. I really respect Steve. He's very evidence-based. He's also a really humble and good guy. I'm really excited to share this episode with you all today. So now, without further ado, I give you Steve Magnus. Steve, it's great to have you back on the Psychology Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yes, me too. How have you grown and changed since the last time you were on the podcast, which might have been 2015, 16?
Yeah, I was going to say it was a while ago.
Sure was.
You know, I like to think hopefully I've grown and changed a lot. I like to think I have. I think if you go back to 2015, 16, I was still in a world where sport and running and that was dominating my life. And since then, I would say that I've gone on this journey where, you know, sport is always going to be something that's important to me, but I think I've kind of zoomed out and maybe gotten a little perspective and realized the bigger picture and what's important.
That's amazing. So in a way, this book that you've written today, it wasn't in your head then. A lot of these ideas about resilience. Did you even have some sort of outdated or some of the kind of notions you push back against in this current book? Did you even have some of those notions in your head around 2015, 2016?
Oh yeah, 100%. Because the culture in sport is so much of like just push through everything.
I see.
And that was definitely my mentality. I mean, back then, even then it was, you don't show any sign of weakness. Like any vulnerability is almost like something that someone could exploit, which I think is obviously wrong, but that's the kind of mentality you grow up in. So even I think if we talked about that at that point in my life, I definitely would have said a lot of things that are counter to now what I believe. So in many ways, this book might represent some of the growth that I've had, you know, as a person.
Well, that's really incredible. Go growth. And since then, there's been some really high profile Olympic cases of individuals admitting that they have some mental health issues and that they don't want to continue. How much do you think that has kind of changed the public consciousness and its awareness around some of these issues?
I do. I think it's amazing because I think what you're seeing is essentially people speaking about the reality of the situation. So you'd hear, you know, in the sports world especially, you'd hear maybe some of these struggles and whispers, you know, behind the scenes, but no one talked about it publicly because it was, again, it was a weakness. It was something that you were kind of ashamed of. So I think people like tennis player Naomi Osaka, Simone Biles during the Olympics, essentially saying, hey, here's the reality of the situation. This is hard stuff. And I'm a human being and I'm going to struggle with things. And here are some of my struggles. I think that message is so impactful because it normalizes the reality. It doesn't give us this kind of fake facade where it's like, oh, everything's great. I'm the toughest person in the world. Like I can go out and do these crazy things and it's normal because it's not. And we've seen it even with, you know, the one of the best Olympians ever, Michael Phelps, you know, normalizing some mental health struggles as well. And I think that is so impactful.
It's so interesting because I think so much of this is tied up with a certain image of masculinity, though, as well. I mean, I feel like this is undeniable in discussing this. I mean, a lot of the culture that you criticize, it's still alive and well. And I'm not going to mention names. I'll let people use their imagination. But, you know, you see on the internet culture of people who
you know, I woke up at 4 a.m. Let's go. I'm not mentioning names, but, you know, there's, and that seems to work for them, right? So, and it's, or is it? I mean, I guess we don't really know their personal life and what they actually go through day to day, but, you know, they rally a lot of followers, you know, their followers feel inspired by it. You know, what would you kind of say to that culture and why it's so popular? Why is it so popular? Why is it undeniably mostly sort of like bros that are like, you know, I'm just being truthful.
No, that's what I love about you, Scott, is you just call it.
I just say it.
But I think you're spot on. And I think there is something about that. I think it's rather appealing because it, for whatever reason, and in the US especially, we have this culture where, you know, it goes back hundreds of years. It's like, well, hard work gets us ahead. Hard work separates us. In, you know, our religions, various religions, it's like we, like hard work, dedication, all of that stuff is celebrated. So I think in a way, it's very culturally tied together so that people almost like, you almost like have to say it to celebrate. So if I say, hey, I'm getting up at 5 a.m., what does that tell me? Well, it tells you, oh, this person's dedicated. Oh, this person's going to put in the work. Oh, this person's, you know, getting ahead while I'm sleeping. But if you look at the reality is over the sustained long term of it, maybe sleep is a better thing than getting up at 4 a.m. And I'm not, if that's your only choice and it's working for you, more power to you. But I think this is what it gets at it is that it's not, it looks good. And in today's kind of social media world, what's going to get more likes and clicks? Like a post of your watch at 4 a.m. and you working out and it's completely dark? Or you getting up at, you know, 7:30, you know, going to the gym and doing something or going for a walk? Like, you know, that's not as popular. So I think it is something that's just in this culture. And then the last part that I have to comment is, it is a little of that masculinity piece that I think is big, right? It's almost like this machismo where we have to show it externally. And I think this gets at the heart of the problem is, it's this external bravado of, hey, look at me doing these incredibly difficult things. I'm getting up at 4 a.m. to work out or whatever it is in the bro culture. When the reality is, and we know this from, as you know, from decades of data, is it's really the internal that matters, that internal motivation and strength. Mm-hmm. And often that is quiet, right? It's, for example, in a non-athletic context, you know this, when you write a book, it's hard, it's challenging, but you don't take a picture and like, hey, I wrote 1,000 words today, every single day, look at me. Mm-hmm. It's almost this quiet sense of, okay, I've got to wrestle with this topic and I'm going to delete some stuff. And sometimes I'm going to go through this writer's block, but like, it's that internal motivation that pushes you to get the project eventually done. And I think that's often what we've kind of neglected.
You raise so many important issues. I'm just thinking of like synchronized swimming or artistic swimming as an example. There are certain sports where clearly the reward and the awe and wonder is how effortless they look. And so it'd almost be taboo in certain sports for them to show how hard they worked in them. And then there are others where it seems like it's part and parcel of the status to show how hard you worked in them. So I actually see it feels like it differs depending on the domain. And maybe the gender thing again, because you don't see many bros artistic swimming, do you?
Right. And I think that's kind of it, right?
Wait a minute. That just dawned on me. Maybe that goes down gendered lines. UFC versus, let's take two extremes. UFC fighting versus artistic swimming.
Right.
Like they seem to, they must differ in the extent to which the leaders in those fields on social media are showing how much work they're putting in. Maybe I'm wrong. Again, people challenge me who hear anything I say. Please feel free to challenge me. But I'm just thinking, like, it seems like there's certain fields where it's like you work so hard that so you can show how, you know, effortless it looks at the end of the day and how beautiful and free-flowing it is, you know?
Exactly. I think you're onto something because it's like artistic swimming. You look at maybe like rhythmic gymnastics and other sports like that where it's almost like be effortless. Don't grimace while you're doing it. Like you're being judged. And then you look at maybe, you know, sports like, again, UFC or football or whatever, boxing. It's like, no, there's a lot of bravado. There's a lot of, you know, we want to be seen as tough and putting in effort.
Bragging.
Exactly. So it's very interesting. This it does split along gendered lines. And I would argue that at the extremes of both ends, we have a little bit of issues, right? Because if in artistic swimming or gymnastics, you're encouraged to like, don't show any sign of like struggle. Well, that's not good because occasionally like gymnastics is tough. Like artistic swimming is tough. Like you're holding your breath all that time, right? Maybe some reality might help. But on the flip side, again, with something like UFC, it's like, well, maybe some reality of, you know, we don't need all of this bravado or external kind of machismo. Like it's still the inner strength that gets you through the difficult moment. So it's both sides kind of have this little piece where we could meet in the happy middle somewhere. Middle.
Yeah, that'd be very nice. I this is on my mind because I saw those breathtaking photos of the artistic swimmer who lost consciousness. And her coach jumped in and saved her. And then another member of the team jumped to save her. The lifeguards, by the way, didn't move at all. You know, and I don't know. Did you follow that story by any chance? You know what I'm talking
about? I did, yes.
Yeah. And you know, I wondered what extent she felt as though she couldn't. Was that a result, you know, of not being able to express, you know, how hard she had to like train and work, you know, and kind of societal pressures? So interesting. There's societal pressures against women saying, you know, how they feel, but there's also, you know, societal pressures against men in saying, you know, how you feel. So it's almost like the men show off how hard they're working, but without any showing any emotions involved. It's like, you know, because that's, you know, just it's like, I'm going to work so hard. Look how I woke up at 4. Look how stolid temperament I am. Look how, you know, I read Ryan Holiday. I love Ryan, but I'm saying yeah. Stoicism. It's like, God forbid you bring in a little bit humanistic psychology, you know, that we're a whole person, right? And that there's more to us than matters. So I don't know. I'm just riffing with you and just bringing up various streams of consciousness to riff on.
Yeah, no, I love it. This is why I love talking with you, Scott, because I think it's even interesting there because, and I love Ryan Holiday and his work. He does fantastic work, but
me too.
Often, even the so-called philosophies we're drawn to also kind of fit into this bigger picture. There's some great things we can learn about Stoicism, but often I think the interpretation of Stoic in the modern world is like, oh, just like quiet, you know, get through the thing, don't show any emotions. I mean, that's what Stoic kind of means, even though that's not what the philosophy kind of suggests. But alternatively, you don't see a lot of bros picking up Carl Rogers or humanistic philosophers, yeah. Right? And it's popular.
I'm the exception.
Right. but it's interesting because we're drawn to, you know, different philosophies that kind of fit this kind of societal, cultural, you know, space that maybe we occupy in without seeing the full spectrum of maybe, you know, what I try and do is like there's some great things in Stoicism that I can pull on that fit in this model of real toughness I'm trying to do. There's some wonderful things from humanistic philosophy that fit in. And it's like, it's wrestling with that nuance and maybe that oftentimes we're lacking.
This is really, really interesting, you know, because I want to go through your four pillars and I want us to not, I urge our listeners to not view these along gendered lines. I think that's a big point of what we want to say here. You know, well, I mean, you obviously are saying it. I'm agreeing with you. You know, we have a shared message. I want us to go through these four and just, I don't want people to see these things through gendered lines. Like the first one was ditch the facade, embrace reality. I mean, you talk about how true confidence is quiet, insecurity is loud. Again, there are the kind of these gendered, you know, things where like women don't talk as much in meetings, don't feel like they're appreciated as much when they're loud, you know, and men, you know, who are loud and who aren't loud, you know, are kind of viewed as submissive. You know, so how can we transcend? Let's transcend these pattern, these gendered ways of thinking, and just make a true statement, which is that regardless of who you are and what field you are, it seems like it feels like the point you're making is it seems like the people who are the most secure within themselves and confident and have mastered the skills and feel confident in the skills don't feel such a need to roar as loudly. Is that the point you're making?
Exactly. That's it. Spot on. And I think what you see is, again, it's almost kind of this external versus internal. And what we know, again, from research and experience is that that internal confidence is what actually lasts. If we come forward and come at things with a lot of, let's say, external bravado, what happens is, yeah, you might get started, but the moment you're faced with that difficult moment where it's like, oh, this is really tough. Like, I don't know if I can get through this. The external fades away. The bravado fades away because you are left with, you have to do this thing and it's just you and that thing. And if you don't have that security to navigate those really difficult moments, and that security is, again, internal and quiet and just, I know who I am and what I'm capable of and what I've done to get to this point. If you have that internal security, you can persist or, like, you know, figure your way how to navigate through things. And I think too much times what we've done is we've kind of thrown that by the wayside. And, you know, my childhood was a great example of this because I grew up in the self-esteem generation where in the 80s and 90s, I think at every elementary school, you know, program was something to tell us we were great. And, you know, you would know better than I do, Scott, but self-esteem is great. It works very well. It's something that is needed. But from my understanding of both the literature and experience, like telling someone they're great isn't the same as saying, hey, you know, you went through this difficult time. You worked really hard on this project or paper or what have you. Like this is fantastic in the sense that there's some evidence behind it, and that compliment or that whatever, telling people they're good at something has some meat on the bones, that works. Just telling people like you're fantastic in a presentation doesn't do much. So I really want to get back to that is like, okay, we need a little bit of reality and evidence behind things. And if we do that, then we're going to be in a much better place.
Oh, for sure. I've been trying to highlight to people the difference between self-esteem and narcissism, because the two are often conflated with each other. A healthy self-esteem actually isn't one where you're constantly being told you're great. Healthy self-esteem usually develops from a warm, nurturing family who is constantly signaling to you that you're worthy, that you are competent, just as competent as anyone else to learn something and to grow. But that's a healthy self-esteem. But that's different actually than narcissism and puffing yourself up in a grandiose way, feeling like you always have to defend an I am great self-schema. That's different than self-esteem.
I love that. And, you know, where my mind goes again is maybe sport, especially youth sport, because often what you see is that support key, people interpret it as like, oh, my child needs to win and I'm going to teach them how to win. And this is going to like give them the confidence and stuff. But that's not what support is. Support is creating, as you said, that warm environment where your child knows, like, win or lose at the soccer game or football game or peewee, you know, baseball, whatever it is, like they're loved, supported, and that you appreciate like the effort they put forth and the things that they're challenging themselves on. And you create that environment, and that's what it's about, not this like win or lose at, you know, 8 years old or whatever have you.
Yeah, exactly. Another one under the embrace reality section of your book, you have a chapter on accepting what you are capable of. And I struggled with that one, quite honestly, because I really have that kind of attitude of like, as a coach and as a, I'm creating a new form of coaching. I'm calling self-actualization coaching. A big tenet is I believe in your potential, you know, for growth and almost don't accept the labels that people put on you, right? As a kid, imagine if when I was, you know, told what my IQ score was at age eight or so. I don't know if you know my life story.
Yeah.
Imagine if I was like, well, Steve says, accept what you're capable of, you know, is what maybe what you're saying is, well, is there nuance? Is there room for nuance here where you can say, don't accept what other people tell you you're capable of, Maybe that's we can agree on that at least. But then there's nuance within your own self and what you accept in your own capacities. What do you think?
I would agree with that. I think hopefully all of my book is nuanced.
For sure, it is. Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know what I'm trying to get at there is exactly that: is to see what you're capable of. You have to occasionally push the bounds, right? You have to test yourself. You have to put yourself in positions and see what's there. I think what I'm trying to get at there is whenever we face challenges, we need some degree of overlap between our perceptions, not other people's, our perceptions of what we're capable of and our perceptions of the demand of the thing we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. So, and what I say is, again, some degree of overlap. It doesn't need to be perfect. Maybe we have, you know, again, stretching our limits so that, but I think where we get in our way often is, again, we almost think, oh, I have to be always optimistic, always shooting for the stars, always thinking that I'm the greatest ever. And often that sets us up for what I'd call a false appraisal, where, again, when we get in the thing and it becomes challenging, it's almost like our brain says, oh, hit the escape button because this is way more difficult than we thought it was. So what I'm trying to get at is, when I say accept what you're capable of, is, again, it's that internal, your perception, not others, and trying to get your perception based on the reality of, like, putting yourself in situations where you stretch your capabilities and see what's there. And that is a positive. And again, I think if we adopt that, that kind of reframes our how we think of maybe wins or losses or failure, because then failure is not, you know, this thing, this personal attack on me, it's information where you say, okay, I wasn't capable of it today, but now I know where my weak spot is or what I am capable of. Now, how do I bridge that gap?
Yeah. Thank you for that clarification. I would reframe that, and maybe in a way you haven't quite thought of it, but you might agree with me. You're saying have humility. Because the definition of humility in the psychological literature is simply your ability to have an accurate assessment of your current ability set.
I'd agree 100%. Actually, when writing the book, I talked to someone who's elite military, and he put it very similar to that. Actually, it was after I was done writing the book, so this part didn't make it into the book. But he said, Steve, when we're out there doing crazy things and surviving and in the midst of the battle, it's not about this unbridled confidence, it's about humble confidence. Because I need to know, it's like just like that humility to understand what I'm trying to do and what I'm capable of this in this moment. And he said, you know, contrary to maybe popular opinion, a little bit of doubt is a good thing because it keeps me sharp and aware in times when I need to be.
Yeah. So can we say two things can be true at the same time, that you can have that humility while also not necessarily accepting the potential that people say that people put on you, especially like school children and well, even, you know, even if your coach tells you that you don't have what it takes, but you believe inside you have that fire and potential for it, that you have the humility in the moment, but you still have the longer term confidence. Can we hold both those in our mind at the same time?
I think that is fantastic. And my wife, who is an elementary school teacher, would agree with that and love that 100%.
Great. Wonderful. Another thing you talk about in the embracing reality section is know when to hold them and when to fold them. Sometimes I say know when to grit, know when to quit. Is that similar?
Yeah, same thing. Because I think, again, in certain sections of our culture, we often have this idea of quitting as being equated to, you know, losing or that you're weak or what have you. And the reality is, you know, sometimes quitting is the right thing to do. You know, in the book, I outlined and I talked to some world-class climbers who climb like mountains like Mount Everest, right? And they tell me, and they'd be, Steve, the tough thing to do is, you know, see the summit, you know, right there. You're capable of getting there. But you can't just be drawn to that one-off goal. You have to sit there and be like, do I have the energy to not only make it all the way to the top, but also all the way back down safely? And sometimes you do that assessment and you say, no, quitting is the right thing, even though you've trained for months or years to make it to that summit. So again, what I'm trying to get at is we've got to do that assessment. You know, it's not about quitting as being some weakness. It's about what's the right thing in that moment.
I love that. And you're just changing goals. I mean, quitting is also a label that you're putting on yourself.
Exactly. I think it's again, there's some fascinating research that shows elite performers from athletics to military to, again, you know, others are really good at shifting their goals in the moment, right? And what that does is it's amazing because we go from, okay, well, maybe this goal isn't possible, but if I can shift my goal, it's like my motivation doesn't fall off a cliff. Yeah. It gets directed towards something else.
Yeah, directed.
And that allows us to like stay in the game and, you know, still do things that we want to do.
Yeah, yeah. For every no, you're saying yes to something else.
Exactly. Exactly.
Another pillar you talk about is listen to your body. And this is an interesting one. And I assume you're not talking to schizophrenics. Own the voice in your head.
Yeah.
So I assume that wasn't directed to.
No, it's not. Again, there's nuance here. But I think often what we look at is we almost see our inner voice as combative, especially in difficult moments, because it's often that inner voice that brings up maybe doubts or insecurities or that urge to quit when we're doing difficult or uncomfortable things.
Yeah, so your emotions are messengers, not dictators. But sometimes it feels like they're dictators. What do you do when you feel like it is a dictator? You know, what about like, you know, people who are addicted to athletic improvement? You know, there are people out there, Steve, who I think the word addiction applies, you know, to the extent to which they must practice. What do you think?
I think addiction is a spot on. I mean, I've actually experienced that in my younger life. I mean, in high school, I definitely went through moments of having to instead of wanting to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a dangerous moment. And what I'm trying to say in this piece with emotions are messengers, not dictators, is they can become dictators. And that's what we're trying to almost keep them in their right place by, again, learning to listen to your body. The example I like to give, again, I'll use an athletic context, but it applies to everything, is if I can understand the difference when I go to work out between pain that is normal and pain or discomfort that might mean injury or that I need to stop. Mm-hmm. And there's nuance there.
There is.
And how do you understand that nuance? Well, you have to spend time sitting with that emotion to understand it. And I think some of the fascinating research lately is around the contextualization of emotions. And actually, I'll go to a story from my wife, who again is an elementary school teacher, who put this very clearly to me. Is she one day said, like, "Hey, Steve, do you know why?" You know, she's taught kindergarten, first grade, other grades like that. "Do you know why kids sometimes freak out and throw tantrums?" We don't have kids. I've only rarely experienced that. She's like, "They're experiencing this barrage of feelings. Maybe it's from like frustration of, you know, getting a graded paper back, or that friends didn't interact with them at recess. But they experience this barrage of feelings that often is unfamiliar and that they have no idea what to do with. And they can only describe it in a very, you know, shallow or minute way. And for example, with five-year-olds, everything is sad. You know, I feel sad. Why? Because they haven't developed the capacity to, you know, distinguish that nuance of maybe the difference between sadness and frustration or loneliness or whatever have you. And as you understand or contextualize that vocabulary, you're able to deal with the thing a little bit better because you can understand it. And as adults, we start to gain that ability. But I really think, again, it's an ability that sometimes we neglect because we shoo away our emotions and feelings. And my message is, you know, you got to learn from them. You got to almost kind of become friends with them a little bit so that you can understand what ones maybe to listen to and what ones, again, that might be false alarms or, you know, false signals that, you know, you can let pass on by.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that like Mark Brackett, for instance, is doing a really good work on emotional literacy in doing exactly that and teaching that to school children. I wonder to what extent Mark has thought through how this can be applied to for coaches in the sports world. And that's something maybe I could get you guys talking to each other. Maybe I can make an intro.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic because it is. It's absolutely a skill that is not developed, but certainly applies in the sporting world. Because again, there's so many nuances of the feelings and sensations you get when you're working out, regardless of what it is, because it's uncomfortable, right?
Yeah. It is uncomfortable. I mean, your book, it is called Do Hard Things. You are still advocating doing hard things. You're not saying like, oh, take it easy. Like, you know, like we focus too much our society on doing hard things and we should just be hedonists. Is that you do still say that that it's good to do hard things, but what you're saying and what you're challenging are the methods by which we do those hard things. You're saying even a lot of the notions we have and are actually making it harder to do the hard things. We could do the hard things in a more efficient manner.
Exactly. I think what it is, and you know, it's almost like this, the title and then the book is, it's almost like Rich Roll told me this, is the title is almost like the Trojan horse. And that, yes, I'm saying do hard things, but I'm not saying go beat your head against a brick wall. Right. I'm saying do hard things, but the way we've traditionally approached difficult things isn't the best way to learn from, navigate, and get through life's challenges or difficulties.
Well, that's because there is a reward system in place in certain communities for doing hard things the hardest way possible.
Yes.
So that is in and of itself the reward in certain communities. You must expect there are certain communities that would read your book and not like your book, but you can't please everyone.
You can't. And there are going to be people who read this and are like, oh my gosh, what are you talking about? But that's why I think I tried in the book to give examples from, again, even the military, which is often thought of as this common, you know, this community that's like, oh, we just put our head down and run through brick walls. But, you know, the U.S. military is the nation's largest employer of sports psychologists.
Yeah.
Right? Why? Because they recognize and realize that if we're going to do difficult things, we need to teach, you know, how to cope with struggles. We need to teach how to cope with adversity and strength. We need to teach people how to build confidence or how to navigate that inner voice or whatever have you, all the different skills that we have. And it's part of the military's curriculum. So my answer is to some of these traditional, you know, viewpoints is, well, if the people who are doing maybe, you know, one of the most difficult things in the world and have a very kind of macho culture are employing these tactics and techniques to get better, why aren't you? And the other thing that I'd say as well is if you look at some fascinating research, one of the reasons the military employs this stuff is because it works and also because they face these problems to the nth degree. There was a fascinating study that looked at people going elite, you know, special forces going through survival training, simulated survival training. And it was something like 96% of them experienced disassociation.
Wow.
Which is, you know, and these are the train the best of the best. So they're sitting here, how do we get these people to be able to keep their mind essentially steady and deal with this chaos? Well, it's the techniques that we know from sports psychology, from humanistic psychology, from positive psychology. There's been a lot of work in positive psychology in the military. So all of these things work even in the most, you know, macho of macho cultures.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, I was very impressed to hear that you ran almost a 4-minute mile. What was it? 4 minutes, 5 seconds? What was it? What was your best time?
4 minutes and 1 second.
I mean, that's incredible. I mean, that's really incredible. And yet, even with that, you wrote something on Twitter like, I can't break that 4-minute boundary. It's hard. It's like, dude, how many people in any generation can run a 4-minute, 1-second mile? It can't be, certainly not in the hundreds of thousands.
No, it's definitely not. No,
I mean, holy cow. So, well, first of all, congratulations. That shows that you have put the work and dedication towards something. When did you do that? How many years ago?
Oh, a while ago. My best was actually when I was 18, I ran 401. And then after that, in the decade after that, I ran everything from 401 to 403 to 405. So I was spent a lot of time right in that low 4 minute barrier time.
If I said, go run right now, you know, you just run out your door and you just run a mile, how fast would it be?
Right now? Gosh, I would probably say like 415 maybe.
Wow. That's how old are you?
37.
Yeah. So was there a point in your life where you're like, wow, maybe I can be a competitive runner? Was there a time where you were aspiring for even like Olympics?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. Especially in my early years in high school and college, that was absolutely a goal and something that I aspired to. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where you work really hard and you see what you're capable of. And I was just a little bit shy of that, maybe Olympic level, a couple seconds shy.
Okay. So the reason why I bring all this up, because I ask you, because back then when you ran that fastest time, I imagine you had a lot of these outdated notions in your head or these notions that you've criticized here. And I want you to just be as bluntly honest with me as possible, because this is really the question. Do you think that if you were enlightened as you are now and you read Steve Magnus's book, Do Hard Things, when you were 18 years old, maybe that would have helped you get under four minutes, or would you have been able to get 4 minutes and 1 second with this different way of thinking? Is the way that the outdated, all those notions you had that you're arguing against, how much did that actually help you, or was it necessary for you to get such an amazing, because you did something amazing?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a great question, Scott. I haven't been asked that. So I think, here's my experience. So back then, maybe to set the stage, I was capable of running really fast, but it had to align with, you know, I was in the right state, in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. Because when I ran, you know, those really fast times, yes, I subscribe to those old school notions. Like I put my head down. I think I literally threw up like after most of my races at that point. So yeah. I was going. But what would happen is I had to go so far into this deep, dark well that if that well was there or happened to be filled on that day, I could do it. I could perform well. But more often than not, what happens is that well is not there all the time. So I would dig deep, you know, try and find that well, and it wouldn't be there. And those traditional tactics and techniques would backfire. And I'd essentially kind of spiral out. Instead of running 401 or 402, I'd run, again, 415 or 420. Like I'd run much slower when it wasn't my day. So as I look back, I think if I had more tools in my toolkit, then I probably would have been more consistent on figuring out how to perform at a high level, no matter, you know, what the circumstances were. And generally, if you're more consistent, it's almost like you have more opportunities for that great day to take advantage of it, because you're always in that spot. And I think that would have made a big difference in my career.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for taking that question seriously and being so honest, nuanced about that answer. I really appreciate it. It's so fascinating how our goals can be so like what one man's what one person's accomplishment can be so different than another person's accomplishment. You know, my goal these days, I've been trying to see how fast I can run a half a mile.
Oh, that's fantastic!
I've been working like systematically on this, and I'm trying to bump up my app because I reached my personal record the other day, which was 3 minutes and 15 seconds. Which, like, you know, look, that's not amazing in objectively, but to me, you know, I cut it down from I started off, it was 4:30, because I really would like to be able to run like an 8-minute mile. So I'm kind of, or even under 8 minutes. Anyway, whatever. I didn't mean to turn the spotlight on me, but it's just so interesting because like that was an accomplishment for me the other day when I ran a 3:30 half a mile. I was like, yeah, I got my personal best, you know, and I don't know, at the end of the day, isn't that what life's all about, is just keep getting your own personal best? I mean, I obviously that won't get you to the Olympics, so that can't be what it's all about. But I don't know. I don't know my point.
No.
It felt good to me. It made me feel alive.
It's
not going to get me in the Olympics.
Yeah. I think there's a brilliant lesson to that, though.
Thank you. Please save this.
No, first off, congratulations, because that's a very difficult thing to do, no matter that just pushing that boundary for a half mile is very difficult. But I think there's a brilliant lesson in this, is that it's relative to you. So for you, 3.5 minutes is a great performance right now, and you should celebrate it. And you should get that confidence from doing that things. For me, like, the barrier might be different. And the brilliant thing, or the interesting thing, is as I age, as we all age, that barrier is going to shift. But it's about, like, doing something that is a little bit challenging, where it's like, hey, you know, I'm going to push my boundaries and see if I can get my personal best or the best that I can do right now. And I think there's something brilliant. And, you know, earlier we talked about Ryan Holiday and stoicism, but in one conversation I had, he said something great, where he was talking about his own running, and I was asking him, like, why do you run? And he said, so I can have something that I win at every day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, even if you don't set that personal best, to me, it's like, it's a win, because it's like, hey, I'm doing this difficult thing that, and striving for something that I've never done before. And whether that never done before is a 4-minute mile or a 8-minute mile, it's still quite an accomplishment to do something that, you know, a month or a year ago wasn't possible.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I also, yeah, I bond with your home slice, Brad Stolberg. He is your home slice, right? Yeah. Homeboy. I bond with him over weightlifting and nerd out with him about that sometimes, because it does feel like a win when you can kind of get a little bit more weight. And that's like very like tangible, quantifiable improvement. Feels good.
Yeah, I think there's just something to it. It's like, it doesn't have to be exercise, but it leads to lifting, running. It just leads to something where, again, it's tangible, and you can literally sit there and be like, I wasn't capable of this, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And it just makes you feel good.
Absolutely. So let's jump into pillar 3, respond instead of react. Now, this is probably the closest thing to Ryan Holiday, stoicism. I mean, some of this is out of his rule book, Keep Your Mind Steady, right? So talk a little about this.
Yeah. So I think often what happens is when we go through challenging times, we often do what I call is react. Like, you're just like, how do I escape this moment? Or how do I fix this as quick as possible? And what I'm advocating for is almost a little bit of like mindfulness, right? Is how do we create the space to make sure that we're taking wise action? And wise action doesn't mean the right decision, because we have no idea what the right decision is. But I think if we can create a little bit of that space between stimulus and response, then we're going to be in a better place to navigate what we're dealing with. And the reason for that is simple, is because often when we're going through challenging times, I almost see it as like our brain starts spiraling. It's almost like that snowball, like rolling down the hill. And once it gets going, it's like, oh my gosh, this is really hard to stop. Like, it's going towards the direction. But what I try to advocate is, okay, how do we create a little bit of space? Or how do we put a little bit of barriers in that snowball to slow it down just enough so that we can deal with the thing that is causing us trouble?
Yeah, it's amazing how much the mind does affect what you're capable of doing and the thoughts you have in your head while you're running, while you're doing what you're doing. I see it so obviously in my own life. You know, if I'm, you know, thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I'm so out of breath, like, can I make it another? And then I tried another trick the other day where I was like, you know what, I'm just going to look at the ground when I'm running. I'm not going to look up and see how far I have to go. I'm just going to look at the ground and basically just like count the specks, you know. And I was able to run so much further. To me, that illustrated something. What did that illustrate to me?
Yeah, so that's brilliant. Because one of the things that, again, research actually shows is shifting your attention works.
Mm-hmm. It worked. It certainly did, yeah.
It works. And what they've actually found, studying, you know, the greatest marathoners, and this applies outside of sport, but it really does, is the greatest marathoners aren't focused internally or externally. They bounce between and shift their attention based on what works in that moment. Mm. So sometimes they might be staring at the ground. Sometimes they might be looking at the crowd. Sometimes their focus of attention might be entirely internally on how their body feels. But it's that shifting, because what happens, or what they found, is we often get stuck. So if you're looking at the horizon and you're just looking ahead, your brain gets latched onto, oh my gosh, I have still have so much farther to go. How am I going to make it? If you then shift your attention to the ground, now your brain almost shifts where it's like, okay, I can't see how much further I have. I'm going to pay attention to like what's going on in this moment, next step, next step, next step. So it's just one of these tools that we can use, again, regardless of what we're going through. And there's some fascinating research that actually ties this to creativity, right? Where if we take a broad view, literally broaden out our view and look at, you know, almost have that panoramic kind of soft gaze versus a narrowed in gaze, we'll be a little bit more creative on, again, tasks that challenge that. Just from changing our attention and our viewpoint. So I think attention, there's a lot of skills that we can use, but attention is one of these primary things where if we learn how to utilize it and shift it, we're going to be in a better place.
That is so true. That is so true. And then let's talk about the last pillar. Let's wrap up here because I'm a big fan of transcendence. And I like how you use the word transcend in your fourth pillar. Transcend discomfort. So why is it important to build a foundation to do the hard things in life?
So first off, I have to give you credit because I chose this title while I was reading your fabulous book, Scott.
Are you serious?
Yeah, we went back and forth with the publisher on all of these, like you always do. And I'm like, we were wrestling with the right word, and I was reading your book again for the second time, and I was like, transcend. How about that?
I had no idea. Yeah. I'm honored.
Yeah. So credit to you. But, you know, to answer your question, I think so much we think of going through difficult moments, and that could be the loss of a loved one or grief or deciding to shift a job. We think of them as individual things. But what often allows us to do the difficult thing is our environment and those around us. So to me, it's going back to, you know, honestly, some of the things you talked about in your book, but it's, do we have the right kind of psychological needs fulfilled that allow us to thrive? Do we feel like we have a voice and a choice and autonomy and that we belong and that we have that level of competency and all those things that, you know, you so greatly illustrate and others, if we have that foundation, we can make it through difficult things. We can better navigate it. And I think that's what it's about to me is it's not just you on your own on this journey. It's how do you create that environment so that you feel like you can essentially maybe tie it all the way back to what we talked about at the beginning. Your environment creates that security so that you can take on challenges, maybe even fail, but you're okay. And I think that's what it's about.
Yes. And I think that your final chapter on finding meaning in discomfort really dovetails really nicely with, the book I have coming out in September, not to plug my book, but why not, on post-traumatic growth and how we can all kind of find meaning in the discomfort we've had during this COVID era. So I just saw a lot of great similarities. I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, no, it's spot on. I'm really looking forward to your book because, you know, in researching this, I don't know the field as well, but I spent a lot of time looking at that post-traumatic growth because it's so true. And I think it's often neglected place. So maybe the final chapter will give you a teaser and then you can go for the full buffet when Scott's book comes out.
Oh, I'll take it. As long as everyone buys your book now, so we can all win-win. I'm about positive sum games. So
love it.
Everyone check out Steve's book. I really like it. I tweeted out the other day that I liked it, and I don't do that kind of stuff that often with many books. I really, really like Steve's book. As I was preparing for this interview, it dawned on me just how similar we are in terms of like and I don't even know what it is, like an essence of being. Is the closest I can get to describing it. I think you know what I mean.
I definitely feel that kindred spirit, Scott. Yeah. No, I appreciate everything you're doing too, and it's making the world a better place. So,
thanks, Steve. I wish you all the best with the rest of your book tour, and thanks for being on the Psychology Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.